The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Myers.
Mr. Outdoors is here. Greg Roberts, good to talk with you here this morning, Greg. And now that we're within that 48 hours of the big travel to grandmother's or grandfather's house or just heading out, are we going to see a whole bunch of snow and lowering snow levels? Or what are we thinking here now that we're getting closer? Because the way it looks on Friday is often the way it's not looking Monday, just the way it goes, right?
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes you're watching things happen that you're still waiting to see how the timing of this is all going to play out. Well, unfortunately for us, for down here in the valleys, for a white Christmas, once we hit the 48-hour window this morning and we could start using shorter-range deterministic models like HRRR and SREF, and then taking a look at a thing called MOS guidance, which most forecasters are going to take a look at, especially the TV variety, because it essentially tells you what to expect, you know, so you can set your forecast up. Like whoever it was we just listened to from KOBI, guarantee you MOS guidance is a huge part of how they're putting their forecast.
By the way, what is MOS? Is that like a something service, or what does that mean?
No, it's basically... I'm going to actually pull this.
Because I was thinking MOS like, you know.
It stands, you know, and of course, I'm doing this and I'm trying to figure out.
That's okay. I didn't mean to get you off
know,
in the
I'm
weeds.
I'm trying to remember what the MOS forecast model.
I don't mean to get you off in the weeds. It's okay. It's
model,
okay.
Okay, here it is. It's model output statistics. So what it does, okay. And I just, you know, I blanked it because I just say it's MOS. Model output statistics. So what it's going to do, it's a computer program that essentially it'll collect all the data from all the various forecast models. That's going to include the two mains, the European, the GFS. Then it's going to include secondaries like ICON, GEM. You know, it's going to throw all of that into the computer, basically, and say, okay, this one sees this, this one sees this.
You know, I never realized there were so many different weather systems all combining out there to try to determine where it's going. I didn't know that, really.
Yeah, there is, and there's a lot of different methodology, and if you're going to look beyond just MOS guidance, if you're going to start looking at, you know, even things far more likely, the two that are most frequently going to be used are the European and the GFS, because those are kind of, you know, you've got the two superior ones that are in use all around the globe. And this tends to be the modeling that your degreed meteorologists definitely use far more. And then it kind of becomes a thing of, well, which one historically has been more accurate? And it's kind of interesting, typically at different times of the years, or different times of the year. Jeez, I'm having a hard time today. Anyway, European...
Hey, there's not enough coffee in my world right now, Greg. I'm with you,
exactly.
Okay? I get
and
it.
And
you know?
Actually, I'm trying a brand new coffee, a gift from a friend of mine that he said perfect for hockey season. It's Tim Hortons coffee from up in Canada.
Oh.
And, of course, it's hockey season. I'm trying it for the first time, and I got to admit, it's good. I just haven't had enough of it.
All right. Now, as far as these different models, though... is anybody talking in your weather world? By the way, Greg Roberts is with me once again, RogueWeather.com. I was reading something. I go through a lot of financial blogs because I just find the money people interesting, because where they're going to push the money to do certain things. Nothing happens until someone's pushing funding to it. And I was reading about talks of quantum computing, and they were saying that it would revolutionize the weather forecasting era, because the current type of computers that we have, which is a linear computer with ones and zeros, et cetera, the binary type computers, are limited on what they are able to do and how many calculations and the way that they calculate, and that quantum computing is going to be the way of the future on that. Are they discussing that about weather? Because that's one of the issues with weather, because weather is chaos. It's chaos everywhere. It's chaos theory all the time, you know?
Well, and Right. And, you know, it's kind of the wheels grind slowly, and sometimes in some things they grind more slowly than others. Meteorology, firefighting world, for example. Mm-hmm. But the other part of the problem is there is an immense field of data that you've got to, you know, basically retool and get set for these new, the quantum side of things with its ability to process so much more, so much faster.
Well, I wonder if there's anything to the, even when they talk about the butterfly effect, in which a butterfly flaps the wings and then, you know, and then all of a sudden the hurricane starts days later, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. The butterfly effect, and we've talked about this, that is, you know, when you look at how the atmosphere operates, the butterfly effect is absolutely true. And this is one of the big challenges that you get in trying to forecast. There are so many X factors that enter into it anywhere, but especially here. You know, Southern Oregon, Northern California, our microclimate zones are in the thousands.
Other forecasters have told me that this area is actually quite a challenge to do reasonable forecasting. It's just hard.
The only place more difficult is southeastern Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Lots of microclimates.
In the continental, in the United States, I started to say continental, and southeastern Alaska, yeah, it would be part of the continental U.S., but it's, you know, we've got lower 48, we've got Alaska, and we've got Hawaii, and that southeastern coast of Alaska is by far the toughest one to forecast within the United States, but we're number two.
Number two. Now, what about the Midwest in those areas, like when I was working at KFGO in Fargo, back in the late 90s and such, and they had three staff meteorologists on a radio station because the weather was so key in that particular area. And I thought maybe it's not that hard to forecast because you just say, okay, the storm's coming, you're going to die. You know, that kind of thing is all you had to do, was say.
Yeah, here's the thing. I envy them their ability to watch things developing out here, to watch things developing over the Rockies, because by the time it reaches Fargo, North Dakota, you've got a really good idea of what's going to wind up happening.
Yeah.
The reason for three staff meteorologists is so that when you're getting severe weather outbreaks, and in this case, more specifically tornadoes, but in the winter it could be blizzards, if you've got three, you're guaranteed 24-hour coverage.
And we did. We had that. And you needed that because the weather was honestly routinely killing people. That's the way it worked out there in the Midwest.
Yep.
The storms there in Fargo, Moorhead, in those areas, and just routinely killing people, whether it's flooding, whether it was the snow, the blizzards and such. And so it was a big deal, very important for people, really was.
Yeah, right, and that's why in Fargo, even in smaller towns, you will have the staff meteorologist with the TV and radio stations that where you might get those people being eliminated first in other parts of the country with budget cut times.
Uh-huh.
They'll be the last ones back there in those parts of the world. And then for down in Florida, because of hurricanes, that's a big essential to keep their staff meteorologists, because like you said, the weather can and will kill people. And one of my favorite things that I heard from Texas all the way to North Dakota was this one: you're a barbed wire fence from hell in the summer, and you're a barbed wire fence from the North Pole in the winter.
Yeah, that's about it too. That's so true. So, Greg, are we going to see a white Christmas after all this? I know I kind of got you off in the weeds. My apologies. Right. But I kind of like to hear how they come up with this kind of stuff and what is developing.
I was building to that. Mm-hmm. We do have Arctic air that's coming in. I put a post up on Rogue Weather last night about that. That is going to arrive. That is the reason that snow levels this morning that are running up around 7,000 feet are going to be down somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 feet by the time we reach tomorrow afternoon, which is why there's going to be impact on travel. Right now, it doesn't look anything severe, but at this time of the year, and especially with all the people coming up from the south and just all the people we have here in general who can't handle driving on any snow and ice, any snow and ice, say Siskiyou Summit around Mount Shasta, any of that's going to be an impact. So, yes, there is going to be some. Is it major to the point where it starts closing things down? Not even.
Okay.
The wind side of it is going to be right now, honestly, far more significant.
Boy, I saw you do a post over the weekend that that the winds peaked out at over 50 miles an hour at the airport here in town.
Yeah. We, our biggest gust that we hit was 58 miles an hour.
Wow.
So when, you know, it was kind of funny because the night before, we might see 45, and especially down around Ashland, Talent. Nope, that wound up being a widespread thing. Saturday morning, I had to go pick up a friend of mine, give him a ride, and he lives over there in East Medford. I'm not going to say close to you, but also not that far away, and driving over to get him, I was pretty amazed at how much debris there was down all over the place.
Oh, we always get amazing winds in that in our neighborhood by Foothill. Yeah. We're not too far from Foothill. I think it's because it just whips around the mountain, the Roxy Ann,
yeah,
you know.
Well, and that, you know, those East Hills in Medford and along Foothill Road and to the east of it, you get that wind funnel effect that winds just kind of curl around Baldy and just follow terrain, and it just goes right up all the way to Roxy Ann and then heads out to the north, and then the valley opens up and the winds kind of lose the channeling effect. But there probably was also some of that. So if the airport was peaking at 58 miles an hour, it wouldn't surprise me if those locations east side of Medford and especially east of Foothill up there in the hills on Roxy Ann, if they weren't seeing higher winds than that.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all. What do you think then about the chances for more heavy snow in the past levels, also Ashland, Shasta, 140? How are they looking? Yeah. Doesn't sound like there's going to be any problem getting out to the coast over the next few days, right?
Right. And honestly, though, what we miss for Wednesday morning, for Christmas morning, and having the chance for a white Christmas, because now to absolutely define that, even though we do have the SREF showing some ongoing shower activity still over Jackson and Josephine counties, meaning the valley areas, and even though temperatures would be enough to support snow, it's looking far more like we'll just see some snowflakes coming out of the skies rather than any kind of accumulation, because there just isn't going to be enough moisture available to get the kind of snowfall rate that we need to get to an accumulation.
So drying out, even though we're going to have some rain and snow possibility. Overall drier.
Right. And the other thing, the MOS, and you're probably going to see, and especially, again, I forget who it is. I know it's not Kevin Lawless doing the top of the hour forecast from KOBI at this time of the day. They're going to be talking about fog on Christmas morning, because the MOS guidance, especially in Jackson County, where it is expected we're going to have clearer skies, Josephine County right now, per the MOS, is definitely looking better for the chances of showers on Christmas morning that may potentially put snowflakes in the air. And Jackson County, MOS is showing it as fog up until about 1 p.m. in the afternoon, and then about 1 p.m. in the afternoon on Christmas Day, here comes the next batch of rain and snow, and that looks far more significant in terms of amount of snow it's going to put down than what we're expecting to see Christmas Eve night into Christmas morning. And I'm looking at the latest. And, yeah, Medford National Weather Service, they're forecasting a snow level around 4,000 to 5,000 feet, which right now everything I saw looking at it this morning when I was running models, I'm going to say it's far more likely it's going to be that 4,000 foot.
Okay.
Could even be lower, but they're projecting 12 to 18 inches from Wednesday night through Thursday night. So 12 to 18 inches for the Cascades. It looks like probably 6 to 12 for the Siskiyous, maybe a bit higher for Mount Ashland ski area. But you get down around Mount Shasta, and the really interesting thing is they're showing less than an inch at Mount Shasta City and I-5, but right up on Mount Shasta itself, when you start gaining elevation, this is where you get another area where you could be looking at that 12 to 18 inch, maybe more range. All areas east of the Cascades definitely will see some snow. It looks like the majority of it is going to be the 1 to 2 inch range, except northern Klamath County and the Highway 97 corridor. So if you're going to try and get over to Bend, you will definitely hit heavier snow from Chemult north towards Lapine, and looking somewhere in the 4 to 8 inches, just by what I can see from Medford National Weather Service output. The model runs I was doing this morning all back that up. All of them had far more significant snow coming in for Wednesday night and in through Thursday than anything ahead of Christmas. But again, this is going to continue. Rain and snow will continue pretty much on a regular interval, the way it's stacking up right now, from now basically through New Year's. So
okay.
When people would be more likely to be returning home because of how New Year's lands this year, being on a Wednesday, that following weekend, because back to school Monday, as I call it, coming out of Christmas vacation is the 6th. Looks like we're going to continue to see rain and snow coming all the way through the 2nd, and then a little bit of a window opens up, and it looks like we may have drier conditions now for that first weekend of January, when, again, it's another big travel period for people.
All right, Greg. Hey, I appreciate that. Got a call for you, I think, there. Hi, good morning. You're on with Greg. Who's this?
Good morning, boys. This is Jim from Jacksonville.
Yeah, Jim.
Hey, Greg, I this is a little bit sideways, but I missed your results of your elk hunt this year. You guys were going to go out and did you tag an elk, or is this a bad?
No, the elk we were chasing are all still, you know, very much alive, and now they've moved into where they spend their winters, which, you know, the good news for the elk is it's very locked up, very private, and they usually don't get anybody in there disturbing them. So the elk we were chasing, especially the big bull, gave us the slip, and, you know, they definitely will live another day. That big bull has absolutely lived to keep passing his genes on, unless, you know, he encounters a cougar or something, you know, unexpected happens to him. He'll likely still be very much alive next year when the hunting seasons come around, because just by what we see looking at him in the game cam photos, he looks to be somewhere around 5 to 6 years old. So he's still in the prime of his life, but we're going to start hitting the decline period for him here pretty quickly.
Yeah, I really appreciate that information, and leaving them in the gene pool is a good idea. Thank you for all of your help this year, Greg, and Bill, also, you have a nice day off. Appreciate that.
Hey, really appreciate that, Jim.
Yeah,
thank you for the call.
And he's saying have a nice day off. Well, especially the way I live my life, there really is no such thing as a true day off. You know, you might have days where you're less focused because maybe the weather's not as crazy, but you're still... I mean, the routine for me is the routine. I'm getting up every morning. I'm taking a look at what's going on, and we have to be ready for the fact that things could go sideways at about any point. And that may happen on Christmas. That may happen on Thanksgiving, you know. But, heck, I go back to the days when I was doing fire and EMS, and you were always...
You're always on call, just the way it goes, okay?
Yeah.
Let's grab another one here. Hi, you're on with Greg. Good morning. Who's this?
Good morning. It's Peter. I was wondering if you can tell me, based on the idea that the progeny of that big bull, it would seem to me with all the academics that set policy that there would be a restriction on taking the best of the bucks.
There's been a lot of conversation in the hunting world about that, hasn't there?
There has. And when they opened up spikes to be legal for harvest in the Western Oregon deer rifle season, there was some controversy about that. But so far to this point, that has not proven to have had a dramatic decrease in the number of bucks that we're seeing. In fact, the last buck that I saw while I was out in the woods was a spike. So spikes are escaping. We're not seeing an appreciable huge rise in success numbers for hunters, either checked in the field by OSP or ODF&W or reporting online. There just hasn't been that big dramatic spike that a lot of people figured would happen when spikes became legal. They can and they do, especially in Eastern Oregon and on the coastal seasons. They will restrict the hunting to spike bulls only because they want those bigger herd bulls to be able to escape and carry on the genes. I haven't seen them do that down here in Southern Oregon, like, ever. I can't remember it in my lifetime. They are issuing more over-the-counter damage tags now for a season that runs from August 1st to March 31st the next year, but it is all entirely up to the hunter to find the private property to gain access to go out and do that hunt. ODF&W is not taking damage reports from people and then sending hunters out anymore. They leave that up to the hunters to do, and that tag down here is designed to be far more focused at taking out cows and also the younger the calves.
All right. Very good. Hey, really appreciate the call, caller there. And final question I have for you. What's your thought about our $38 million wildlife overpass over there at Milepost 1.7 that's about to be put in or will be put in now that it's been announced with the Grand Stream funding? I don't think it's the worst idea that I've seen when it comes to getting the animals over the interstate without getting whacked, and probably save a lot of drivers some trouble and potential danger too.
Well,
but
it definitely will reduce human trauma. It definitely reduces wildlife deaths. It's not like this is an untried idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's about time they're finally doing it over here, because when you jump on Highway 97. And you're taking off from 138. By the time you hit Bend, you will have gone over four of those.
Right.
And they work.
And there's a bunch. There's a couple of them on Highway 22, from what I recall.
Yes. And it's a big proven success record. And I'm thrilled to death that they got a brain and decided to put one in on I-5, because it's very well known that the Siskiyou Pass area on I-5 is a major, major wildlife crossing point, because it is the direct route for wildlife to move from the Cascades to the Siskiyous and then eventually the Coast Range. And I've been waiting for them to do this from the time we realized how successful they truly were. The mule deer population east of the Cascades continues to go down at a pretty alarming rate.
Now, do you think that when they put this in, though, in all honesty, will they camera that up so that people can kind of see the what kind of wildlife is traveling over it from time to time?
Because they camera it up, and I'm not sure how much they make that publicly accessible, so you could sit and watch it in real time, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But they do put cameras in, so ODF&W, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, all the wildlife agencies will have access to see exactly what is coming through and utilizing that. And, you know, again, they work. They know it works because you immediately get a reduction in wildlife versus vehicle collisions. And, you know, you just – it you see – the wildlife, when they realize that's there, they definitely flow in.
Yeah, they'll go there instead of over the road. Yep. That's fine. Now, now you are not allowed to set up your hunting.
No, definitely
okay.
not.
And just kind of thinking, right?
Safety zone.
All right. Right. No hunting zone. Got it. Okay. That would make sense.
But I'm just going to say, now, of course, on 97, the other thing that they've done, and you will see this, they have put up miles and miles of real high fencing along 97 to discourage deer and elk from using any other point other than the wildlife, in those cases, the underpasses, and the deer and the elk and everything else has gotten the message. They use them.
All right. Now, this may be a really dumb question because I'm not really all that experienced with these, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a possibility that even though humans won't be hunting on the... you know, the overpass. You're not allowed to do that, right? That'd be poaching, yep. et cetera, et cetera. Do the predators hang out on those areas and wait?
Well, we know the predators use them. We've uh-huh. already seen cougars, wolves. I mean, basically every predator you can think of in Oregon has popped up in the cameras on the wildlife underpass.
Yeah, but I would just wonder if a predator would then look at this as shooting fish or deer or anything
they
in a barrel.
Seem to, though. Uh-huh. I'm not seeing anywhere that anybody's documenting natural predation occurring in higher instances around these.
Okay, all right. Just thought I'd ask. And,
yeah.
Have that assuaged then. Hey, have a wonderful weekend. I will catch you a week from Friday as we get into the new year, and we'll have a lot to talk about, I'm sure, there, Greg. Okay?
Yes,
thanks.
Yes, we will. And, the last thing I definitely wanted to say before we get out of here, Mount Ashland is still sticking to aerial reopening to everybody on Wednesday, on Christmas Day. So, great news. The damage that looked really bad in that photo they made public did not appear to seriously damage that lift tower,
good.
Which was great news. And they are stating aerial will return on Christmas Day. So, excellent news there. And then the last thing I want to say, you know, again, thanks to everybody who listens. Had it happen again in the store yesterday. I was in Winco grabbing some stuff for dinner last night and had a couple people tell me how much they enjoy listening to you and I do what we do on the radio.
That's good.
And we deeply, Bill and I both, deeply appreciate every single one of you listening to us right now. We truly do. And wish everybody a truly Merry Christmas.
All right. Merry Christmas to you, Greg. Greg Roberts at Rogue Weather. Kind of an extended one. I wanted to find out a little bit more, though, what the actual computers were. That's why I got into that. I got a little bit off into the weeds there. But every now and then, I just know nothing about this, but I was reading about the quantum conversations and everything else. Thank you, Greg. Greg Roberts over at RogueWeather.com. It is 7:42 at KMED. We're going to check the rest of the news here in just a moment. And by the way, Oregon Truck and Auto Authority on Airway Drive in Medford is the sponsor of the Outdoor Report. We tend to do it every Friday in this particular case, Monday before the big holidays are coming up. Oregon Truck and Auto Authority. Now then, news is coming up. We have some open phones. We're going to do a Diner 62 quiz. We got Dr. Powers talking about history. The Christmas history in the Rogue Valley. Going to be very nice. Looking forward to it.
As 2025 approaches, Dusty's Transmissions extends heartfelt
Patriot Electric. And to all, a good night.
You're hearing the Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
Bob writes me this morning saying, Bob, what happened with the cameras in the restroom story out of Grants Pass? I had that. I talked that about that when I first came on this morning, Bob. I appreciate you asking me again. I ended up talking with a city official, Bradley, who ended up being in charge of facilities, and he says there's absolutely no truth to any talk about those little boxes inside those Portland loo style. These are the bathrooms that are over the public restrooms that are where raving lunatic, drug addicted, homeless like to cause all sorts of mayhem. It's why they end up having these kind of these stainless steel, easier to clean out kind of places, kind of indestructible loos, as they call them. And he still insists that they are infrared, sensors to turn on lights and turn on the blue lights, especially the blue lights that keep you from wanting to shoot up inside there. And then other people who I think may have been behind some of those anonymous letters that were going out about this, writing me over the weekend, I could mention, saying things like, well, I went in there and they didn't turn on and off and yada, yada, yada. And they're still insisting that they're cameras. The city insists that they are not. There are people who are insisting that they are. Without me getting into that box, I probably couldn't really say one way or the other. I will tend to err on the city of Grants Pass being correct on this one, and other people being incorrect or not being able to really grab it. The other thing I would add is that they would say that you could put some toilet paper on it and then it wouldn't turn on or wouldn't stay off or things would stay on. There are delays that are set up on all of these things. And once once they turn on, maybe they're on for 10 or 15 minutes. I don't know how that works. But I got to tell you, given the problems that we've had with the drug addicted raving lunatics that have been running our streets and ruining bathrooms and such like that, there's a part of me that almost hopes that they do have a camera or two in there to take note of who's in there so that when there is a problem, they can go back and figure out who's causing their trouble. Now, I would imagine there is a way to do a headshot where you were to take a view of the restroom without violating anyone's personal biological processes, right? You know, those kind of things. Maybe there's a way to do that. I know state statute may not permit that. But I got to tell you, we're at this point with so much damage. I don't think that we have a duty to provide shooting galleries for the homeless here in Southern Oregon. We just don't, for the drug addicts. We can't. We can't do that. And maybe there's the other theory that I may have on this is that it's supposed to look like a camera and maybe freak some of the people out. Maybe that's part of it. It could be kind of a decoy of sorts. So the city tells me, the person who answered the phone said it was nonsense, and then the facilities manager, Bradley, that I ended up talking to, said absolutely no truth to this. No cameras in there, that they are infrared sensors. That's all I can tell you, all right? That's what we know, okay? Carrie writes me this morning, Bill, heater core. I'm changing the heater core in a 1996 Corvette. 2 days of standing on my head. Oh, man. Oh, man. You have my sympathy. That's a very difficult car to service, just period, right? Any of those kind of more exotic cars, that's for sure. Carrie, salute off to you, okay? There we go. We'll catch up on the rest of the news here in just a moment. Diner 62 quiz. I think we'll do that in just a moment, too. 770-563-3770-KMED. If you have won this in the last 60 days, you can win it next. Little ho-ho-ho happy Christmas for you.
Discover exceptional senior living at Prestige Care Senior Living, where comfort meets care. Visit PrestigeCare.com.
Find gifts for everyone on your list for less at Coastal.
Hi, I'm Corey with Patriot Electric, and I'm on KMED.
Appreciate you being here for the Diner 62 Real American Quiz. By the way, Randy wishes everybody, by the way, Randy and the crew from D62, saying Merry Christmas. Now, they'll be closed for Christmas, but through the holidays, all those amazing specials are still there. Hot open-faced sandwiches like the pot roast sandwich with mashed potatoes and brown gravy, or the hot turkey sandwich with tomatoes gravy and cranberry sauce. Mm-mm-mm. By the way, Friday of this week, still Clam Chowder Friday, even in the holidays. And a couple of pork chops and eggs or 8-ounce New York steak and eggs on special right now on the weekends. All right, let me go to, we got Jerry. Jerry, how you doing this morning? Welcome.
Hey, good. Good morning.
Jerry, today it was, it was today in history, December 23rd of 1867, Madam C.J. Walker is born, okay? She was a future entrepreneur, philanthropist, self-made millionaire, Madam C.J. Walker, born Sarah Breedlove in Delta, Louisiana. Walker's parents and sharecroppers who had been enslaved died when she was 11. Walker eventually left Louisiana, spent her 20s in St. Louis, Missouri. By the time of her death at the age of 51 in 1919, Walker's business was producing an annual revenue of $500,000, $500,000 in 1919. That was real money then, okay? And she had amassed a large real estate portfolio, including the mansion Villa Loaro in Westchester County, New York, and a palatial townhome in Harlem. Now, according to the history, folks, Walker is now considered to be the first female millionaire in America, Jerry. What product or service started and built her empire? What made her a millionaire in 1919? Was it A, Scotch whiskey? Was it B, hair tonic? Was it C, jams and jellies? Was it D, gardening tools? Or was it E, dry cleaning? It's one of those five. What do you think?
I'm thinking it was the hair tonic.
You're thinking it's hair tonic? Of all the things you make $1 million on, hair tonic? Seriously?
I think I remember this quiz, actually.
Yeah, you're right.
You're a winner!
You got it. You know, sometimes having a little bit of trivial knowledge is good. Isn't it, Jerry? Worked out pretty well. And she was working as a laundress for about $1 a day to support herself and her daughter. She developed a hair loss problem, and then Walker began using products produced by the black hair care entrepreneur Annie Turnbow Malone. She found success, inspired to create her own line of hair care products. The Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company started selling Madam C.J. Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower in 1906 using sulfur, copper sulfate, beeswax, petrolatum, which I think is like petroleum jelly, coconut oil, and a violet extract perfume. Her company at its peak would go on to employ over 25,000 women. It's an interesting story. And they nicknamed them the Walker agents, who made house visits across the United States and the Caribbean. And by the time she died in 1919, Walker's business producing an annual revenue of over $500,000. And like I said, that large real estate. She was the first one, first female millionaire. Pretty interesting stuff. And we're going to send you to Diner 62. Hang on, we'll get you all set up, okay? Thanks, Jerry. 757.
We've all done it. You approach your vehicle and see a scratch or a ding. Grim
of mind. Incogni.com.
Good morning. This is News Talk 106.3 KMED, and you're waking up with the Bill Myers Show.
Town Hall News is coming out here in just a moment. By the way, I wanted to mention, wanted to thank the folks at Clouser Drilling. Clouser Drilling, the sponsor of Mannheim Steamrollers and American Christmas on KBXG, the jukebox, which is going to start tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, and on KMED's Fontana Roofing. KMED Fontana Roofing is the sponsor of that, and we really appreciate that. And it's one time of year that You guys got to face the fact of the matter that the B, C, and D teams are going to be in the talk radio world tomorrow. That's just the way it goes, all right? Because all the main hosts, they're taking the day off for the most part, or else they're going to do a best of. And it's kind of funny when you hear them doing best ofs, and it's a there's an interview of someone that's talking about, well, if Donald Trump wins, sometimes it's just better just to. What is it? Either fish or cut bait. We'll cut bait tomorrow here, but then things are back to normal. The Hugh Hewitt Show filling in for me through the next week or so, and I'll be back on the 2nd after New Year's, okay? But I appreciate your listenership, and we also thank Clouser and also Fontana Roofing for the sponsor of An American Christmas. All right, good stuff. It's a couple minutes after 8. KMED, KMED, HD1, Eagle Point, Medford, KPXG, Grants Pass. We're going to be talking about the history of Christmas in the Rogue Valley, what a typical Christmas was like back in the day. It's a little bit different from our waiting for the Amazon truck and or going over to the malls and all of the other stores. But we'll have that coming up, along with your calls and opinion and some more emails of the day before we take off.
Lose your car key or remote.